welcome to The Sound of Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and we are joined today by Heather Graby and Guntram Wolf, two of Bruegel's fabulous scholars. And Guntram also is here today representing the Solvay School of Business here in Brussels. We are all together around a table to talk about the costs of climate change. Specifically, the planet is changing and things are getting expensive dealing with it, with the weather, with the changes to construction and insurance needs, all kinds of stuff like that. So we are going to talk today about what all of that is costing and focus later on what we might be able to do about it. Guntram, how has our understanding of this changed over the years?
Well, Rebecca, thanks for hosting me. So in my work at the university, at the Solvay Brussels School of Economics and Business, we are looking into exactly the question of how climate change impacts our economies, and then through that impact, how it does affect our financial system. And let us start with really the discussion on the impact of climate change is now very visible to citizens every day. But we also see it as economists really in the numbers. And since I'm an economist, let me talk about the numbers and less about the pictures that we all know. The numbers are, first of all, that the number of global reported natural disasters has really gone up tremendously. I mean, in particular, since the last, I would say, 15, 20 years, these numbers really have gone up substantially. And we are now at globally reported disasters of 400 per year and more. So this is really significant. Now, the second point I want to make is that really the economics profession has looked at this issue for quite some time, actually, and has been initially really complacent. If you look at the first papers in the 90s, William Nordhaus has a famous paper in which he tries to estimate the impact of climate change on the global economy, and he comes out with these estimates that are really negligible. I mean, he comes out sort of saying, okay, it might cost 2 or 3% of GDP by 2099. So in 100 years, perhaps we lose 1 or 2 or 3% of GDP, given that annual growth is probably something like 2%. I mean, that's like, okay, 1 year of annual growth that you suffer. So that's kind of nothing, right? And in all fairness, we have to say also in the 90s, when he did these estimates, of course, the climate change wasn't yet so visible, right? And we had very limited data to actually estimate this. By now, the numbers of the most recent research are much, much higher. And I think this is due to, first of all, the availability of much better data. We see now what's happening and, you know, damages have become visible and are there in the data. And of course, also our climate projections have significantly deteriorated compared to the 90s. And let me just sort of mention two papers that I think are useful to reference. I mean, one is by Kotz et al. It was published in 24 in Nature. I mean, they find that GDP impact could be in the range of some up to 20% of GDP by the end of the century, meaning every year we produce 20% less than we would be producing if there was no climate change whatsoever. And that is in a scenario in which essentially we get our act together, right? So essentially we manage to contain emissions and reduce them to net zero by around the middle of the century. In a worst scenario, which I think is politically probably the more likely one, these impacts could be much, much higher. And the second paper I wanted to also reference is a paper that is written by Bilal and Kencik. So they are both hardcore economists, I think, at Northwestern University in the United States. And they have a different empirical methodology, and that's why it's interesting to look at it. And they find essentially that a 1 degree Celsius increase can lead to lower GDP by around 12% globally. So they come therefore with really significant numbers as well. And what I find quite interesting is that, you know, these two papers have very different approaches. One is much more natural science driven, much more regional data. This one by Bilal and Kencik is much more macro data. And they both come actually with very significant numbers by now. So I guess in sum, and, you know, I guess Heather will talk about a paper that was just published a few days ago on Europe, more specifically, but I think what the picture is overall is that given that climate change is deteriorating, given that natural disasters are increasing, given that our data gets better on this, we are actually seeing that this is not just sort of some fringe issue for our economies. It really affects our value added, our production processes, and therefore has substantial costs. And therefore, it's really worthwhile to think very carefully about how do we tackle this issue.
We're beginning to see the impacts of climate change in a physical way. This is changing perceptions because as human beings, we tend to think rather short term. And it's only when we feel the droughts, the heat waves, the floods and the storms year after year that we begin to start to think how big the scale of the change might be. And we're also, in the economic profession, beginning to look at the cumulative effect of all of these impacts. So if we just take what you might call the fast onset events, the natural disasters that the Guntram was referring to, the number of them is going up. The frequency and the intensity of them is going up globally. So first of all, that means that you can have those events in many regions at the same time. So in the past, for example, you might have a crisis that affects a commodity in one region, but other regions keep producing, say, rice or maize. And that means that global prices aren't very much affected. But if you now have more frequent events, more intense events, they coincide and they happen in multiple regions. So then you start to see more global effects and also effects on supply chains where others in the supply chain are also affected. They can't simply try and find a different supplier of what they need. So that's one thing to think about is coincidence of events. Another one to think about is the way that there are cumulative losses. So there's a recent paper that Guntram was referring to by University of Mannheim and the European Central Bank that looks at the combined events in the summer of 2025 and looks at the overall impact on reduction in output, which is about 43 billion euro. And they reckon that by 2029, we could be thinking about 126 billion reduction in output in Europe as a result of extreme weather events. So that's where you can see also regional effects can be much more intense. And in Europe, we are actually warming at twice the global average. So in Europe, we are actually more vulnerable both to the heat effects, but also we're very import dependent. The fact that we rely on bringing in not only a lot of energy imports, but also lots of intermediate goods and finished goods, that makes us more vulnerable than other regions, like, for example, the United States. And finally, I think we have to think really carefully, not only about the fast onset events of disasters, but also slow onset events. So the slowly reducing capacity of glaciers to give us water because they're melting, the dropping in the water table and the emptying of aquifers, which means there's less groundwater available. So you have not just a drought 1 year, and then you expect that the rains will come back and that water will flow through the river the next year, but you have a permanent water stress and reduction in availability of water, which is key not just for agriculture, but also for loads of sectors, for example, chemicals. So these slow onset events are beginning to become more evident as well, and those will have an accelerating effect as we reach tipping points where glaciers are gone and also where sea level rise begins to happen.
It's so interesting to hear you both talk about this accumulation of weather events and changes at the same time that the political climate is definitely still acting like the expected long-term change is not going to be that much. How do we reconcile those? I mean, these two things are happening very much at the same time.
The politics and the science are unfortunately moving in opposite directions. And we see in the United States politics trying to suppress the science and actually remove data from the public sphere. So that's a big problem in itself. But there's also the difficulty that governments want to mute the effects. They don't actually want the economy to feel the effects. That's understandable, not wanting people to suffer and not wanting to have economic damage. But what it's doing is often muting the signals to businesses and to households. And that is not giving them the right incentive to adapt, to change their practices, either in terms of mitigation, of taking more effective climate action, or of just adapting to protect themselves for the future. So one way that governments are doing that is by simply bailing businesses and households out when there's an extreme weather event like a flood. So quite a lot of countries, including in the European Union, don't actually have any kind of a national disaster fund. They simply take money out of the current budget to pay for bailing out people who are affected by a flood. We saw that in the Netherlands, for example, a few years ago. And that means that businesses don't go bankrupt as a result of that flood.
that reduces the short-term damage, but it means they have less of an incentive to move. If they're in a floodplain that will continue flooding much more frequently than it did in the past, it might not be good for them to continue to be located in that area. So that's one way that they're muting the impact, that basically the taxpayer rather is muting the signal. Another way is through insurance, where insurance has an important role in the economy of setting a price signal on risk. If you can't get insurance, or if insurance is really expensive, you know very well it's not a good idea to buy a house or build a business in a particular region. You have an understanding of the risks because the insurance company is telling you, this is how we price the risks in this area. But if governments come in and force insurers through regulation to offer insurance, or they put a price cap, or they provide a state-funded insurance policy for that region, then again, they're not actually telling businesses or households, hey, this is a really big problem for the long term. You shouldn't be investing here. So this price signal muting is, I think, a really big problem. We need to think about how to balance that and how to set up the incentives for adaptation for the longer term.
Guntram, how do you see governments going after this? Would you agree with Heather's assessment of the budget, or do you think they are consciously trying to push the public awareness on this more than just the bailouts would suggest?
Well, I would say a couple of points. I mean, the first point, I mean, I very much agree that the mood on mitigation, so attempts to really reduce emissions, is shifting. And in a sense, there's many reasons for it. I think one simple reason is that it's costly, to switch to green. And on top of it, we now have actually the consequence of climate change to deal with, right? So it's a sort of a double burden. That's why I think there is quite a big of push to actually think about adaptation and work on adaptation. That's happening in many respects very decentralized, right? I mean, people just buy an air conditioning, right, and put it in their house because they feel sort of they cannot sustain the summer months otherwise, right? I mean, so lots of people and individuals and companies are reacting. But of course, that's not enough, because there's a systemic dimension to adaptation, and we need to sort of think about systematically how to do adaptation. I guess the third point I want to make here really is sort of these natural disasters have impacts on assets as well as on GDP. And, you know, when I worry about this from the perspective of a macro finance person, you know, I think the key channel I would worry about is really the financial sector and the insurance sector channel, right? Because the assets that we're talking about are often sort of housing assets, right? And housing assets, especially for private households, are often the most important asset that a household has. And we know that insurance coverage gaps exist and actually get worse, because insurers basically stop insuring certain houses in certain places, which is actually what they should be doing rationally, so that houses get moved somewhere else. But as they do it, I mean, you're still stuck with the existing stock, right? And so people living in these houses have a problem. So I think there's then a sort of financial implications, I think, are not yet well enough understood. And there's a sort of a big debate on how big the financial implications are and to what extent this will be a problem for the balance sheet of banks and, you know, potentially financial stability issues. I know that this debate, some people argue, well, basically banks and insurers, they are sufficiently flexible, and especially the banks, they can get out of their loans and then move shed the risk, the climate risk, immediately. But, you know, the problem really is that even though banks have 5 to 10 year loans, even for mortgages, they cannot not rolling over the mortgage, right? I mean, someone will have to take over the mortgage, and unless you think households all of a sudden can pay the remaining mortgage just out of their cash deposits, which I think is certainly not going to happen in most cases. So you really have perhaps not a bank-specific issue, but you have a macro risk that I think is rolling at us in some of these regions. And then, yes, how does the government react, and what's the best government response to this? And, yeah, fiscal policy can play some role, and I think it's reasonable to use fiscal policy for failing out specific cases. Yes, there is a moral hazard issue, right? I mean, so we need to be clear. The more you do this, the less incentive you create for households, for companies to actually adjust to climate change. But basically, this will be a very, very complicated debate, how much you sort of balance moral hazard on the one hand, sort of the necessary bailouts for the financial system, but also from a social perspective for the individual households.
The political economy is going to get more and more difficult, actually, as governments who are elected by people now want to respond to their current electorate. And it's quite hard for them to plan for the future on that basis. They're not going to, you know, the people, if you think about the fact that climate change is going to have bigger and bigger effects across this century and the next century, no government really wants to be responsible to voters who haven't been born yet. So there is a fundamental time problem with the way that democratically elected governments deal with this issue. They are much more likely to privilege those who live now over either those people in the future or those who aren't voting yet. But there's also the difficulty of thinking about fairness within countries and communities. So one of the dilemmas that governments face in responding to this is, if there's something like a drought, do they privilege a strategic sector which they consider to be fundamental to their economy rather than households? So an example of this would be Taiwan, which had a drought, has a very important semiconductor industry, and they gave the semiconductor industry privileged access to water and rationed it for households. Now, that works on an island which is heavily dependent on one sector. That doesn't work for, say, Germany. Already, you know, households in Germany are paying 2.5 times as much for their electricity as heavy industry is. What if that started to be applied to water and other inputs? So you've got a fairness issue and big issues around, okay, what really are our priorities in this society? There's also fairness across countries and regions. It's more likely in Europe, for example, that southern part of the European Union will be affected more than the northern part, especially in the first phase of climate change. I mean, you know, if the ocean currents change and the Gulf Stream stops, then northern Europe will be dramatically more affected than southern. There's really deep uncertainty about the effects, especially once climate change reaches tipping points. But if we just look on current trends over, say, the next 15 years, southern Europe, the Mediterranean, is really going to be affected. So this becomes an issue within the EU about solidarity, because we have a single market, we have very interconnected economies. It makes sense for problems that are occurring in the southern countries also to be paid for by the northern. But we've had this issue before on lots of things, and solidarity has proved to be rather thin and rather fragile in crises. So how to think about that? But that's important also because otherwise manageable climate-related production disruption and transport and so on, it affects the whole supply chain. It doesn't just affect one country, one region. It can also affect all the others in an interconnected economy that depend on the production of that region. So for that reason, we may start to look at EU climate adaptation as a much bigger priority. The Commission is currently coming up with a plan for this. They're going to have a climate resilience strategy issued next year. I think that will be a first testing of the water of how far the member states are prepared to go. But over time, they will need to look. I think there will have to be a much bigger thing at EU level, because this needs to be coordinated across the continent because of the interdependence of European economies.
Gudrun, we're talking a lot about percents, 1%, 2%, 20%. Can you put some actual numbers on that? We're talking billions, trillions?
Well, I mean, sure. So look, the GDP of the European Union now from the top of my head is something around 20 trillion.
That's per year?
Per year. So that's annual value creation per year. So that's 20,000 billion, right? So that's a pretty big number with lots of zeros. So if you're talking here of losing percent or two, I mean, you're talking of really sizable amounts in the three-digit billion range. So these are significant losses per year. And, you know, I think basically, I mean, okay, so insurance loss, I mean, losses of that magnitude, of course, happen. They happen for all kinds of reasons in large economies. But of course, the European problem here, and I think Heather pointed to two important points. I mean, the European problem here is that, first of all, the European continent really heats faster than the rest of the world. And that means extreme weather events will be much, much more frequent than they used to be. And what is now called an extreme weather event in 10 years might be just a regular event, right? So we are really really seeing also how all these weather curves are changing very significantly. So this is, I think, really doesn't bode well for Europe. So we will see more and we will have to adopt more and more significantly than we have done in the last 20 or 30 years. And that will be costly. The second point I wanted to echo is this issue of tipping points. I mean, there is a very important paper published in Nature by Rockström and others arguing basically tipping points too risky to bet against. And so the basic point being that as we continue to sort of drive climate change with continued emissions, and globally, let us remind our readers and listeners that emissions continue to grow. I mean, despite all the measures around the world, our global emissions are annually growing. We haven't reached peak emissions yet, meaning climate change will get much worse before it will get any better, if at all, right? So we are really on a bad trajectory still. And so that means basically we are constantly betting against nature and the natural stability of sort of ecosystems, natural stability of weather systems, even of physical systems. And the Gulf Stream is one of the big examples which would directly affect Europe. The Gulf Stream keeps the north of Europe warm, and the Gulf Stream might stop. There are some serious physics researchers basically saying this could happen in the next up to 10 years even. And if it stops, I mean, all of a sudden the UK becomes Siberia or Canada or something of that sort. So that's big changes, right? So I think, and we haven't really figured out how to think about these kind of changes. But if that were to happen, I mean, imagine what it means for the housing stock in the UK. I mean, you would have to completely rethink all the housing, the insulation, et cetera, et cetera. It would be dramatic change. I mean, just to give you sort of one dramatic example. And so I think it's time for us to go in our resilience strategy beyond sort of these more linear risks where things will get much worse, and think really about the more disruptive scenarios as well.
In the second half of our podcast, I'd like to talk more about the nature of these risks and the way we perceive them, as well as the things that we might do to meet them. Listening to you both over the course of this, on the one hand, we're talking about air conditioning, which is dealing with a warming planet and is maybe adapting buildings that were constructed using more modern techniques that aren't as resilient to warm air as older ones that were built to cool themselves. So we're talking about air conditioning, but we're also talking about heating. What do we do if things get a lot colder? So you're moving in two directions at once. We're talking about weather patterns that are too scary to bet against. But also, we all know from experience that the best way to predict what the weather is going to be tomorrow is to see what the weather is like today. And so it's hard to convince people that their best bet is really to look for the extreme when their lived experience tells them their best bet is going to be something more or less like what they've got today. Heather, how do we cut through that? Leaving aside what's going on in the US with removing data and with actively refusing to look at these, if you asked a lot of people in Europe, are we more affected by climate change than the developing world, than islands that are maybe getting overrun by rising sea levels, or places in the US that have these huge hurricanes or fires? How do you convince people that Europe is also affected by this?
It's hard because Europeans have been used to a temperate climate for tens of thousands of years. We are not used to these kinds of extremes. Now, we're a wealthy continent with high GDP per capita. So there's also an assumption that we can use infrastructure and technology to protect us. And we can, to a certain extent. You know, more air conditioning means more electricity usage, but we can also build more renewables to provide that. But our infrastructure was not built to deal with extremes in the way that it has been in other parts of the world. For example, the railways in Spain were built to deal with maximum summer temperatures, which are now regularly being exceeded. We also have power systems, which were not designed to deal with a storm coming every year, but things that were happening once every 50 years or once every 100 years are happening once every few years or even annually. And over time, that reduces the resilience both of all of these systems, of the infrastructure itself, because it gets more eroded, more damaged, but also of the society. people can recover and rebuild if they experience a flood once in 100 years. When it's happening once every 3 years, then the community becomes unable to recover in the same way. So you have to think about costs that are persisting beyond physical damage and the erosion of resilience over time. And in Europe especially, where you know Mario Draghi has been telling us very clearly for a year now, we have overly low productivity. We need to improve our productivity. This is going to reduce our labor productivity even more because people can't work in the heat. We have excess deaths, so mortality because of heat waves. And also, overall, our efficiency goes down and our demographic pressures are continuing to rise. So it's this combination of climate impacts with these existing problems with productivity and demography that's going to make it really difficult to deal with at political level as well, because people don't want to hear the bad news. And at a moment when you've got rising populism, parties that are perfectly prepared to say, there's a simple answer to this, you know, we just get rid of immigration and we won't have any more problems in our society. There's a lack of willingness to look at the harsh realities that we're going to face a more difficult future in Europe. And we've got to start preparing for that now, both in terms of community resilience and solidarity between countries. So that's a political issue, as well as looking at the physical questions like how to upgrade our infrastructure to cope.
Guntram, does Germany just feel immune to all of this? They're not in Spain with the overheating trains. They don't have a coastline that's vulnerable in the same way. Does this just seem like those southerners not planning for their own future again?
Oof, I mean, I'm not sure. I think there is a debate, let's say, in terms of sort of north-south divisions. And I think as Heather also eloquently showed, I mean, these issues, while at the moment they are still more sort of geographically located in the south of Europe, many of these things are actually moving to the core of Europe from French nuclear reactors that cannot run in the summer because of lack of water, to the heat waves that also Germany is experiencing, right? And by the way, even Sweden and Finland are experiencing heat waves nowadays. So I think this issue is widespread. It will affect all of us. I think the debate on adaptation is certainly ongoing also in Germany in a big way. That is at the moment mostly looking at agriculture and forest management, but it's also increasingly about heat in cities, yeah, and how to adapt cities for heat waves. And I think more and more investment will go into this. And my sense is, just to sort of take the broader point, that Europe, of course, as a continent, will be affected a lot, but will also have much more means to react than many countries in the emerging world or emerging economies or even really poor economies, where basically even the cost for adaptation is not there. So if I was to worry about one thing, for example, then I would worry about heat waves together with humidity waves in India, for example. I mean, there is really now evidence, scary evidence, that we might very soon sort of exceed the threshold of livability in certain parts of India and certain times of the year, where then unless you have access to air conditioning, I mean, basically the human body cannot sustain the heat combination with the high humidity.
The wet bulb.
So that's the kind of things where I would get really worried and scared, right? Because that could mean deaths in the hundreds of thousands or even millions. So I think Europe in that sense has the capacity to adapt. We are more resilient. We have the resources to do so. It will be very difficult for us to do it as well, but let's not think that be a worse than emerging economies.
Absolutely. And of course, this takes us to perhaps the biggest hot button political issue about climate adaptation, which is that people are going to have to move. More parts of the world will become uninhabitable for human beings, which means those human beings will have to find somewhere else to live. And already we can see the way that small island states are saying, well, you know, once our land is under the sea, we need to have somewhere else to live. And given that migration is already such a big political issue in Europe, but also elsewhere, we're going to have to find a different way of thinking about people movement. The notion of a climate refugee is still a bit of a kind of arcane subject, but the notion of movement and the need for people to move in order to adapt, but also for the global economy to be able to cope with climate change, is going to become really central. But I wanted to bring in one other key issue where the politics is really going against what needs to be done to be able to deal with climate change, and that's the issue of nature. The most effective technology on the planet so far, both for absorbing carbon, which is photosynthesis, i.e. plants, but also for cooling vast areas and maintaining fresh water creation through the hydrological cycle, is nature. If we continue to lose forests at the current rate, we will be reducing the capacity of every region to have fresh water. If we continue to destroy nature where we're losing biodiversity, we will be adding to the climate impacts with loss of pollinators for crops, for example. Plus, it's trees and plants which cool both cities and the countryside. They're absolutely essential for keeping the temperature from going even higher. But at the moment, the politics is going very anti-green. And we can see that in the European Union, there's still quite a lot of political support for the energy transition because we can't afford to keep importing fossil fuels. So that's still going ahead. But there's a real pushback on the idea of nature protection being a priority, and that there should be sustainability policies and regulation that protect nature. In fact, we may even be seeing the opposite. We may be seeing the removal of protections of nature in various ways. So thinking about how nature can actually reduce the impact of climate change on us, on both individual human beings and the economy, is absolutely central to understanding where policy now needs to move, particularly at EU level.
I mean, nature's tricky because a lot of the forest and other things that the EU is focused on are not within the EU. So it raises all sorts of questions about who's making decisions and are those decisions really doing what they're intended to do. There's a lot more debate about the how than the why. In general, people think, sure, nature is great. As we move toward the end of this, I think we need to talk about financing somewhat. We need to talk about where the money is going to come from to make these adaptations and to meet these needs. So often the sustainable finance debate focuses on explicitly sustainable investing, battery development, or zero emissions types of products. But it sounds like we're really talking about investment that's needed across the entire economy, just plain old building things and taking care of people. And that's not something you can label as an explicitly green investment. Guntram, what do we need to do to our markets to make private investment more accessible to do this, just on a societal scale?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and I think a great topic to explore further. I mean, let me perhaps start with the statement that in the housing sector, the needs for funding are tremendously high. We need to not just insure against extreme weather events, but we also have to actually adapt to climate mitigation requirements, meaning if you're in Brussels, just to give a specific example, I mean, most houses are actually in low energy standards, right? And so if you want to reduce emissions, eventually that will mean upgrading their insulation, and there are strict regulations on this, perhaps too strict. I mean, there's a debate on this. But anyway, I mean, this is a significant cost for households and for societies to actually do these kind of renovations. And can the banking sector provide that funding? Sure. The question is, can the households afford it, right? I mean, so I think that's the key issue here. On the market structures themselves, I mean, we are looking into also at the chair at the university, which is a chair actually on sustainable finance. We are looking at the green bond markets, which I think, as you rightly describe, are very much bond markets that are sort of focusing on mitigation measures. It's much less about adaptation. It's much more about mitigation. But the good news here is these markets are actually growing. The bond markets are growing in Europe, in particular. This is very much a European market. It's not so much a global market. We see that the European side of the market is bigger than the American one, which is quite unusual in bond markets, where typically the US dominates. And I think we are probably at a moment where sort of these initial sort of confusions around what exactly constitutes a green bond get gradually clearer. I mean, so I think there is still not a perfect market definition, not a perfect sort of precision of how to get this market. But in principle, I see our capital markets increasingly having the capacity to actually raise funds for specific climate projects. I'm actually fairly optimistic that this market is a market that goes overall in the right direction. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if the emergence of these green-oriented financing projects increase interest in markets in general. Europe for so long has had a bank-dominated economy and has been reluctant to embrace exchanges where people buy and sell securities, financial instruments on a regular basis. And that type of market dynamism has made it much easier for the U.S. to pivot and to get funding where it's needed compared to the U.S., where the bank loan process tends to move more slowly and not necessarily scale up where it could when it could. Heather, do you see other examples of a culture shift either happening or resolutely not happening? You mentioned migration. People don't want to provide homes to all these people coming from dramatically different regions of the world. What else is going on?
Well, just to think about the impact of climate on the financial sector, there are also some deeper effects that we should think about. For example, we were talking about the withdrawal of insurance and the affordability of insurance, so affordability and availability of insurance. When you can't get insurance, you can't get a mortgage. So there will be a very big effect on credit markets if it's not possible to be able to insure against risks. That's a very big market functioning problem. Not only economists and economic policymakers, but people across society are going to have to start to think about climate change costs and risks that just were never there in their mental models before. And that means that the climate change will also come into politics in a different way. So far, a lot of the political debate has been about how much is this transition going to cost us? Cost us as an economy, cost us as individuals. Can I afford a heat pump? Should I buy an electric vehicle? And so on. Now we'll move into a phase of having to think about much bigger issues to do with, will my house retain its value? Will there be increased migration into my country or out of my country as a result of climate impacts, or even in or out of my region? So the physical effects of climate change, not just the financial effects, and also the risk side of it, not only the opportunities, but the enormous risks that are now coming through climate change will start to appear on the horizon. And at the moment, politics is not structured to deal with those. At the moment, what we have is green issues in some countries are very much focused on a particular party, a green party. Sometimes they're seen as a left-right divide. The left is interested in green, the right is not interested in green. Everybody will be interested in climate in the future. But what kind of policy solutions will they come up with? What will be the choices that parties put before voters in how to deal with the impact of climate change? This opens a whole new realm in politics.
So as we finish this conversation, I'd love to get some predictions from both of you about just the next couple of years, say 3 to 5 year horizon. Is there one either shock that you think will force us to have a reckoning with this, or perhaps evolution that you see in response to the other trends that might give us a little bit of reason to hope?
I think as Heather put it, is really right. I mean, every year we will see more dramatic, on average, more dramatic extreme events, right? And I think that will shift public debate. It will shift the political system. It will mean that often at the regional level, the mayors, even the states, I mean, or the sub-states, the regions, they are basically starting to worry about this and to adapt and to invest. And households, of course, will do it. And of course, also companies will do it. And so I would say 50, at least 50% or 60% of what needs to be done will be done more or less automatically by people just realizing, okay, I have to do something, right? Now, then there is a problem, which is basically the externality problem, right? I mean, the solution cannot be that everybody puts simply an air conditioning on the roof. I mean, there needs to be a strategy on greening the city. There needs to be a strategy on working together, on creating, I don't know, natural water supplies that will make sure that there's water also downstreams, et cetera, et cetera. So there are major externality issues where I think governments will be called upon. And yeah, I mean, I think at the moment, the backlash that I see against green is mostly a backlash against mitigation measures. I think the adaptation approach and agenda will become more mainstream in the political system. So let me be the optimist here.
The great temptation for governments will be to go primarily for short-term solutions. You know, Marine Le Pen in France calls for everybody to have air conditioning, for example. But actually, what governments are going to have to do is to think about long-term structural solutions. Putting an air conditioning unit in each individual room, like you see in, for example, New York City, creates a heat island effect whereby the overall city is hotter than it would otherwise be. So what you actually need is to create green spaces, trees and white roofs, these kinds of solutions. So that's just a small example of the very large scale changes that need to be made at a structural level to adapt to a changing climate. And what's tricky for governments is going to have to find the money. So where's the investment going to come from? What kind of fiscal burden does that mean? Will debt be sustainable? And a colleague of ours, Stavros Zenios, has done a Bruegel paper on the sustainability of debt with climate adaptation. So that they've got the money problem. They've got the problem of who gets the money. So which sectors is it going to, you're mainly going to prioritize the needs of business and of industries or of households or a bit of both? How do you do that? Then they have the problem of, do you mainly try and protect assets which are already there, such as housing stock? Or do you try and build new things, new infrastructure, for example, which is more climate proof? So there are some really difficult decisions to be made going forward. And those, they need to be made also in a more coordinated way. Otherwise, you're going to waste an enormous amount of money, either one government to the next, you know, flip-flopping, changing policies, or countries doing things which make climate adaptation more difficult or more expensive for their neighbors. Like, for example, building flood defenses that direct the water into a neighboring country. So there are a lot of very difficult trade-offs ahead. And the sooner we start to have a serious debate based on the science and the magnitude of what is coming, really in the short to medium term, as well as the long term, the better.
You've been listening to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, joined today by Heather Graby and Guntram Wolf. You can find links to a few of the papers we've discussed here in the show notes and many of our other Bruegel events on finance and the Green Deal and similar things on our website, Bruegel.org. It's all there. It's all free, just as you can find this podcast on all your favorite podcast channels. Thanks for listening. See you next time.